Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Faith Radio Mornings here for the 8th of January. This is our program, part of our Faith Radio Network, that if you listen, you know we talk about news and topics of the day from a distinctly Christian perspective. We're not going to try to tip into some of the clickbait or conservative or liberal ways in which the news is presented. We're going to try to keep our eyes fixed on Jesus together, for after all, he really is the only king of the eternal kingdom that knows no end. And I'm your host for the show, Dr. Peter Kapsner, joined in studio. You know, again, if you listen, by Rachel Sutton and Paul Perot do a great job bringing guests from around our country that can talk about so many of these topics from different angles and different perspectives, filling my desk with news each morning. Enjoyable to be with all of you listening as well, and at any point you want to join the show this morning, go ahead and call at 877-933-2484 or text the studio at 877-933-FAITH. Well, looking forward to hour one here as we get started on Faith Radio Mornings. We're going to be joined first by Tommy Binion of the Heritage Foundation, who does such a great job covering the headlines out of Washington, D.C. For us, we'll talk a little bit about the border wall dispute, the government shutdown, the fact that the president is going to be live on air tonight on all the major networks making his case for funding of the border wall, and any number of topics coming out of Washington, D.C. We'll also talk about Urbana Conference with Gregory Yao coming up and some of the challenges facing missions in our world today. It's really been a change, a fundamental change in our world as young people are no longer going overseas for missions at the same rate that they were, very interested in matters of social justice like sexism and racism. And Gregory is going to help us understand some pathways forward in our faith and our country as we're experiencing such a change of the tides. But before we get to all of that, you know, again, if you listen, that we talk a lot about hope here on this program, that we really are part of this kingdom that knows no end. And so in getting started this morning, whether you're heading off to school for this morning, whether you're going off to work, or maybe just trying to get yourself out of bed after the third time with the snooze, just stop for a second and reflect on some of the words with me from the Message translation of the Bible from 1 Corinthians 15, in which Paul talks about the future that we do all have in front of us for those of us that have given our lives to Jesus. He says this: "Let me tell you something wonderful, a mystery I'll probably never fully understand. We're not all going to die, but we all are going to be changed. You hear a blast to end all blast from a trumpet, and in that time you look up and blink your eyes and it's over. On signal from that trumpet from heaven, the dead will be up and out of their graves, beyond the reach of death, never to die again. At that same moment and in the same way, we'll all be changed. In the resurrection scheme of things, this has to happen. Everything perishable taken off the shelves and replaced by the imperishable, the mortal replaced by the immortal, and the saying will come true. Death swallowed up by triumphant life. Who got the last word, O death? O death, who's afraid of you now?" And so with all of this going for us, my dear friends, stand your ground. Don't hold back. Throw yourself into the work of the Master, confident that nothing you do for him is a waste of time or effort. Welcome, everyone, to Faith Radio Mornings for this 8th of January. We'll take a short pause, and when we come back, I'll be joined by Tommy Binion of the Heritage Foundation.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the Capitol City.
Welcome back
it's
to Faith Radio Mornings here at about 9 minutes past the hour. And that music means that Tommy Binion of the Heritage Foundation is joining us. Tommy works with the executive branch of government out of Washington, D.C. Good morning, Tommy.
Good morning. Happy to be back with you.
Oh, Happy New Year. Did you have a third child or anything over the break? I mean, how are you doing right now?
We had a second child.
Right. I just didn't know if you managed to get another one in. You know, you had some time off there.
Oh, no, not yet. We had, everybody who was any type of kin in town for an entire month. So we are taking a deep breath and getting back to life as normal, and we're very happy about that.
Well, Tommy, I hear a lot about that, and I know in our experience the transition from 1 to 2 was the transition that just about killed us. I know for some people it's 2 to 3, but 1 to 2, you never really seem to be off the clock at that point.
Yeah, you know, it's a full-time job, but it's full-time joy as well. I really can't come on here and complain. We have so much to be thankful for, and we feel really blessed.
I love it. Well, it's sure good to hear your voice again here as we start 2019 together, and I know there's quite a few headlines out of Washington, D.C., Tommy, and we're going to see the president apparently on TV tonight for a short period of time making his case for the border wall and the government shutdown. Do you have any updates out of Washington about what we can expect this evening?
Well, you know, what this looks like to me is an effort to refocus on the problem that he's trying to address. Right? We have a crisis on the southern border. It is insecure. It's porous. We've got both illegal immigrants, but also those who would want to do us harm, those who traffic drugs and humans coming across our border. And I think he's going to focus on that. I think he's going to talk about, as Americans, why we should want a secure border. You know, we have heard Speaker Pelosi make the case that the border wall is immoral. If I were advising the president, I would tell him to make the case tonight that an insecure border is immoral. And the only moral approach to this would be to secure our border and make it a much safer situation for the border states and for the rest of the country. I think that's what we're going to hear. It's President Donald Trump, though, so it could be kind of a roller coaster. Let's wait and see.
Well, it's interesting to watch the back and forth. They sort of painted themselves in a corner where the president has said that we will not fund the government until we have a wall, and the Democrats will say we will never have a wall. And yet there is supposedly a commitment to border security on both sides of it. Tommy, is there? I don't know if you're too in deep with some of these conversations about border security, but can you get away from a wall and have drones and electronic surveillance and have it be effective in terms of controlling the border?
There are ways other than a wall to secure the border, but that doesn't mean that the wall doesn't make sense. You know, I would say that, by the way, the president has shifted from talking about a wall. He's talking about what he refers to as, steel slabs, which are authorized under a law that the Democrats voted for. You know, I'm not sure that the issue is any more border security. That's the issue by name. At this point, it's who's going to win. You're right. Both sides are entrenched, and they're entrenched to where there's no room between their collective positions for compromise. So to end this, one side has to lose and one side has to win. And I'm not saying that that's a good thing. I'm saying that's politically and from a policy standpoint, I really can't see an end road to how this shutdown ends because of how entrenched both sides are. One side is going to have to lose this, and neither one seems resigned to it or willing to accept the loss in any way, shape, or form.
And as part of it, too, Tommy, looking forward already to the 2020 election cycle, that if a side does back down here, they might enrage their base, and they'll be in some serious political jeopardy.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. The Democrats are there's 24 of them competing to be the presidential nominee. And however they respond to the present crisis is definitely going to be part of their campaign. It doesn't seem to be a winning political strategy on the left to, you know, work with Donald Trump. As Americans, that's unfortunate. We need our leaders to work together. 2 years away from a presidential election is too early to refuse to work with the sitting president. I think that that's really disappointing. But again, you know, today's day 18 of this shutdown, and it's a partial shutdown. It's only about 25% of annual discretionary spending, and the president has done a lot to keep most of the government functioning and opening. But we're in day 18 now, and there's really no end in sight. I say that. About 700,000 federal workers are going to miss a paycheck for the first time of the shutdown on Friday. That's going to change the news cycle. That's going to affect the talking points. Seems to me that both sides are sort of waiting for this address to happen and then waiting for the news cycle around the paychecks on Friday to kick in and see if anything changes. But for right now, they're just sort of sitting across the table with their arms crossed.
Mm. Tommy, one more quick point on this subject before we change the conversation a bit. But there's been some rumblings out of the White House that President Trump believes it's at least possible he could declare a national emergency and from that basis secure the funding for the wall, sort of doing an end round around Congress. I know that some legal professors have come out and on either sides of this. Do you see that that's even a possibility for the president?
It's definitely a possibility. I'm not sure it's an advisable possibility, but there is a really credible, really strong argument that I think wins that he could do this. On the other hand, if you're President Trump, if you're any president, you have to consider if you take a new action of executive authority, if you assume a new power, you have to know that the next president is going to assume that same power. And I'm not sure that Donald Trump or the Republican Party or conservatives want the next president to have that level of executive power in this type of situation. We know that we want the president to have power to act swiftly in a national emergency. I do think the crisis at the border is a national emergency, but I don't think it's a new one. It's been around for years, decades. And Congress has yet to act on it. I'm not sure that a failure of Congress to act makes a national emergency, but I haven't made up my mind yet. It's an open question and an interesting one, but I really think that whenever there's a question like this, you have to judge it not just on the present situation, but whether or not you want that power to belong to that branch of government over and over and over again for the next century. And the answer to that question for me, I always want the government to have less power.
Hmm. Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see. And to your point, Tommy, you can kind of see both sides of it, so it gets tricky to know which direction to go. Well, why don't we take a little bit of an early break just because we have so much to get to, and I'd love to get your feedback on some of the headlines coming out of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's proposal that we can do a Green New Deal, as well as the idea that there's been some proposals floated to just do away with the Electoral College altogether. So lots more to get to with Tommy Binion next from the Heritage Foundation on Faith Radio Mornings. The show, chatting with Tommy Binion of the Heritage Foundation this morning, as we do often on Tuesday mornings, going through some of the headlines out of Washington, D.C. And Tommy, I have to admit that I sort of thought that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's star would kind of fade in the background with all the new Congress people as well, but she seems to be more and more emerging into the spotlight, not least of which because of her proposal related to the idea of a Green New Deal, hearkening back to the language of FDR, in relation to the idea that we need to fundamentally transform our economy to be carbon neutral, and maybe even levying up to a 70% tax on certain earners in our economy. Where do we stand with this? It seems to be getting quite a bit of traction among some of the presidential candidates on the Democratic side.
You know, it is an idea that the hardcore left and the progressives that they favor. This is the lifeblood. These are the new ideas. This is what gets the Democratic and the progressive and the liberal base excited, are these proposals. And I would say for that AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she sort of speaks for that wing of the party. And she's grabbed headlines with the Green New Deal, with Medicare for All, with free college tuition. You name it. If it's an expensive government policy that we can't afford, she's for it. I want to be clear, none of those three proposals, especially the Green New Deal, is going to be enacted in the next 2 years with Donald Trump in the White House or Republicans in control of the Senate. But this is the type of thing that the Democratic base could get excited about and then could demand of a Democratic Congress or a Democratic president when they get in power. So that means Nancy Pelosi has a choice now. Does this Congress pursue these? Do they have votes on them? Do they have hearings on them? Do they continue to generate more and more attention around these policies? Or are they just too far left? And are they out of reach of even a Democratic majority in both chambers and a Democratic president. And so why get your base excited about it?
Does
as
it,
far as the Green New Deal goes, go ahead.
No, just that's what I was going to ask, is there seemed to be some the idea of so much of the environmental conversation, that very topic does seem to have some traction. So, yeah, tell us more about this exact Green Deal.
Well, so, you know, it is if you are a person who is concerned about climate change, concerned about, you know, an existential crisis facing the globe, it's the kind of thing you would be attracted to. But if you sit down and look at what it says and what it is, what it amounts to is the government mandating that everybody use certain types of energy and not other types of energy. It would be an economic disaster that would lead to economic collapse. Energy, fuel, gasoline, oil, coal, wind, all the things that power our economy, that's the lifeblood of our economy. And if the government is choosing winners and losers in that industry and choosing which types of energy we can buy and which types we can't, the types that they say we can buy, well, guess what? The prices will go way up. And the types that we can't buy, well, they will disappear. We won't be able to afford that energy. And the economy will not run as it's supposed to. I think even if you are concerned about climate change, there are free market principles and market forces that you can put to work to try and reduce our carbon emissions that we have done more than any other country in terms of reducing our carbon emissions in the last decade or so. I think this Green New Deal is misguided, and I think it's way too expensive. But more than that, I think it'll surely lead to an economic collapse. Once that becomes clear, it will be only the hardcore progressives that are talking about this, and I think that'll spell doom for the Democratic Party.
Well, and Tommy, is it possible to maintain a limited government and more of a free enterprise kind of system and do the work in the environment at the same time? It seems like the rhetoric is that you can't do both of those things.
No, I don't. I think it's definitely possible. It's not going to be the government that does the work in the environment. It is going to be companies. It's going to be individuals. It's going to be choices we make. Now, you know, all of us make choices every day, and they all have an impact. The complete misguided thing to do, and there are always unintended consequences, and there are always big economic disasters that follow, is when the government attempts to make those choices for the individuals, for the companies, or for the market at large. In this case, individuals are going to end up making choices. If climate change becomes a problem, if it's an existential crisis, then individuals are going to make choices that will affect the outcome. They're not going to do it because the government has mandated them to do it. It's just a backwards way of thinking, in my opinion.
Talking with Tommy Binion here of the Heritage Foundation. And Tommy, one more topic to get into for sure this morning, and that is that there were some proposals floated in the House of Representatives that it's time to do away with the Electoral College and the system of electing the president and go to just a pure popular vote. What do we see going on with this situation?
Well, you know, I think that is an attempt to make a point that President Trump lost the Electoral College. Of course, the truth about that is that if it were a direct popular vote, the vote would go very different. You know, in some of these states, the outcome is pretty clear before Election Day, and so it depresses the turnout. And so the popular vote, I don't think, is a reflection of where everybody in the country is. If we had mandatory voting or 100% turnout, sure. But, you know, for instance, this is just to illustrate the point. In California, surely Hillary Clinton was going to win California in 2016. And so Republicans, you know, if there were another million or two of them that stayed home, that would be understandable because their vote wasn't going to change the outcome. In a popular vote, they may have showed up. But we have the Electoral College for a reason. It's enshrined in the Constitution. It will not go away without a constitutional amendment. And there is a layer of protection just in a worst-case scenario there's a layer of protection between the popular vote and becoming the president. That protects us from tyranny, that gives us sort of a backstop, a fail-safe, if you will. If there is a proposal to change it, let's hear it. But changing a constitutional amendment is a far cry from enacting legislation, and it's much harder to do. I think The more realistic way to look at this is an attempt to make a point about what happened in 2016, and I think the point is wrong.
And it certainly, I saw, I think it was a senator that came out and said, it's time for us to abolish the Electoral College. We did abolish the idea of representative voting for senators and have gone to just pure popular voting. So we should do the same thing for the president. But part of the Electoral College, if correct me if I'm wrong, Tommy, is to protect the less populated states from being overrun by the more populated states.
Yeah, that's absolutely part of it. We have a republic, a collection of states that's represented by our federal government. We have federalism in this country. The federal government isn't the only government. So the patchwork of states, the interest of states in and of themselves is really important to our system of government, and we can't forget about it.
Talking with Tommy Binion here from the Heritage Foundation. Tommy, what do we see? Any other things coming out of some of the legislation that maybe were below the radar over the last maybe week or so from the House of Representatives as the power has shifted in Congress? Do we see that there's a possibility that maybe even the president and the Congress could work together on some things?
Yeah, well, there's definitely that possibility. I like to remind people, I like to go back to Kavanaugh and say during that time, during the gnashing of teeth of the Kavanaugh confirmation process, it was those exact same weeks that the House and Senate was working on the sweeping opioid legislation that was bipartisan, that both parties embraced pretty much wholesale, that the president signed into law. So even when the acrimony is at its height, the parties still work together on certain projects. Infrastructure is a candidate for those projects this spring and this summer. I'm, as a fiscal conservative, I'm hoping that it's paid for or that the $1 trillion cost of the package is offset. In a more immediate sense, the Senate is going to be working today on a bill to attach sanctions to the Syrian government, and that's an interesting vote. It's going to take place at 5:30. It has the support of 90 or 95 senators across the aisle, both parties, but the Democrats are saying they don't want to vote on anything that doesn't have to do with the government shutdown until that's over. So they may all vote in unison against it, but certainly Syria is a big driver of the conversation here in Washington.
Well, Tommy, it's great to hear your voice again as we start the new year in 2019. I've so appreciated the contributions you've made, the insights that you have from Washington, D.C. for the program. And congrats again on number 2 in your family, and I hope you just have a great start to the new year.
Well, happy new year to you. Thanks for having me back. We'll talk soon.
Sounds good. We'll take a break here on Faith Radio Mornings for Lighten Up and some bottom of the hour news and come back and talk a bit about Urbana Conference and missions and what we see in the future in the millennial generation for bringing the kingdom of God around our world. Well, sure, looks like the Midwestern United States is going to see quite a bit of wind today. There's a wind advisory, a blustery day in store for eastern Iowa, in which we see Cedar Rapids and Waterloo could have wind gusts of up to 50 miles an hour. We see that is also true in North Dakota, where cities like Langdon might see 46 to 48 miles an hour. It was a bit windy when I woke up this morning, and tomorrow's recycle day, which means with our family of 7, we've got 2 full recycle cans, and I fully anticipate seeing a lot of aluminum laying around our yard when I get home. Yesterday, Dr. Linda Mintel joined the program, and she talked about losing her father just before Thanksgiving and how grief it takes place over the holidays and how we can handle it moving forward.
But churches should acknowledge, and I don't hear a lot of that. I know that a lot of churches have grief groups. There are some really good ones around the country that are excellent, and people get together. And especially during the holidays, those groups can just be help with emotional healing so much. So it's good if a church acknowledges that, maybe have a Sunday school class or something for people with loss. That would be a really unique way, just to do a session or a couple of Sundays on that as you're approaching the holiday. Again, as the church gets more in touch with wholeness and, you know, we're body, mind, and spirit, and bringing in those emotional things from a biblical perspective is just a really good thing to do. The Bible is very specific about rituals and traditions and remembering and leaving markers, talking about people. God tells us all the time to remember. So I think it's good to bring that up and then check on people to see how they're doing.
Dr. Mintel just touched us so deeply yesterday when she was talking about some of the stages of grief and how we can walk out moving life in this world when we have lost people and what the church can do in those situations as well. If you want to catch that entire segment, you can go to myfaithradio.com and search for Dr. Linda Mintel. Well, off air, I was just talking with Gregory Yao from InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, and he is obviously part and parcel to the Urbana Conference, and that triannual conference just happened, and Greg is going to join us next with some reflections about some good news and what he saw in the young people there.
I was born that way is not an excuse to justify wrongful behavior. This is Jim Garlow. I have a deep concern and love for one who struggles with his or her sexual identity. We all have flaws and failures in our life, for which we'd love to dismissively say, "Oh, I was born that way." We can choose not to act them out, however. That's called maturity, self-restraint, self-discipline. The relentless coercion of perversity we're experiencing in this country is not about having the same rights. It's about destroying anyone who dares oppose moral depravity. The radical LGBT cause insists on infringing on others' rights of freedom of thought, of religion, and freedom of speech. They're demanding that everyone agree with their behavioral choices. We must stop using identity politics as a way of demanding entitlement, claiming injustices, and blaming others. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
It's about 20 minutes before the top of the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings, and we're joined at this time by Gregory Yao, who is the Senior Assistant to the President for InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. And Gregory is joining us this morning with some reflections on the recently held Urbana Conference. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. It's always great to chat with you, get some reflections in terms of some of the things you and InterVarsity are working on. And, of course, the Urbana Conference has been around a long time, Greg. I know it was a big part of my growing up as well. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what happened in this most recent version of it?
Sure. The Urbana Student Missions Conference is sponsored by InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. We had about 11,000 students gathered in St. Louis on December 27th through the 31st, and the goal of every Urbana Conference that we've had since 1947 is to present God's call to global mission to this generation of students. And I think one of the things I loved most about this conference was, you know, we had over 1,753 students say, "I'm committing to long-term service in global or cross-cultural mission for more than 2 years after Urbana." And it's part of the way God is mobilizing people to take the gospel from every nation to every nation.
Well, and Greg, it's got to just be phenomenal when you see those kinds of commitments made. I mean, there's a part of it when I hear those stories that it sort of reminds me of the early followers of Jesus in those first books of the New Testament, the book of Acts, that they just said, you know what, regardless of what comes, we're going to follow and we're going to bring the kingdom to different places in this world.
Absolutely. And one of the great things about the Urbana Missions Conference is we invite speakers from around the world to present the call to global mission. So it's not just North Americans telling North Americans to go, but our Bible expositor, a young man named Rene Bruel, is a Brazilian Christian who's gone to plant a church in Rome. And I think it reflects what's happening in global mission is that the global south, the majority world, is actually becoming mission-sending churches. And they're sending churches to Europe, to North America, to the United States, to other places to help re-evangelize places where faith has grown weaker.
And as these sorts of voices are coming into play in this, Greg, I mean, it really represents a diversity and yet a unity of purpose. And it's one of those things maybe that the church can really engage with, if I understand correctly, in terms of saying we're not here just for diversity's sake. Diversity is a value that's important, but it's a diversity that represents so many different dimensions of the kingdom.
Absolutely. This Urbana Student Missions Conference, 63% of the participants were people of color or international students. And when I talked to a number of our international guests at Urbana, they said, this is more representative of the global church. This is actually what it looks like when we say people of every tribe, nation, language, and tongue will be gathered before the throne of God. And there's a unique power to that kind of witness because it tells us and it reminds us that Jesus is just a tribal deity or the deity of one person, but Jesus is the God of all nations. Jesus is the one to whom all nations will give allegiance. And these international visitors said, if the North American church looks like this, then I have great hope for its future and I have great hope for the mission enterprise, because it really is diversity that testifies to the unique power and glory and majesty of who Jesus is.
And Greg, when I hear things about Urbana, there's a sense in which when we gather together like this, we're part of a bigger story. We're part of a bigger calling. I think that taps into some things in the human heart that with the technological tsunami that sort of swept over us over the last 15 years, we've become more individualized, more sort of connected to our phones and the things that interest us as opposed to the bigger picture. Is that part of what you see and part of the hope of an Urbana kind of conference is that people are maybe coming from different walks of life and yet we're being swept up together into a larger story?
Absolutely. I think right, the key to global mission, if you understand the scriptures, is it begins in Genesis chapter 1 when God says, fill the earth and subdue it. Declare my glory everywhere you go. And it continues as a thread through Genesis 12 and Abraham's covenant, through the Psalms into Jesus's ministry, life, and Great Commission, all the way to the end. And at Urbana, we chose to focus on the book of Revelation for that primary purpose. Students spent 8 hours in in-depth Bible study and then heard about 5 expositions on the book because we wanted to remind them that they're part of a much greater story, a story about who Jesus is, that he reigns, that he rules, and that he triumphs in the end and has been since the beginning, right? He's the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And in part, it's to call students out of smaller obsessions, out of managing their image on their phones, out of consuming the products that they want, out of pursuing vocational goals just because it will make them comfortable, and hopefully catch them up into this greater story that God has been telling and God has been inviting us to participate in.
And Greg, as we talk about some of the bigger picture that's happening in our world and at Urbana and with our young people, were there any sort of personal interactions or just a personal story that you walked away from and just sort of stuck with you since that time?
Oh, dozens. 2 quick ones. On the morning that we were focused on Revelation 18, which is where the Spirit calls the church to come out of Babylon, and Babylon in that section of Revelation represents all the anti-God impulses of our world, the consumerism, the self-sufficiency, the pride. It was to ask students, come out of that and embrace the kingdom of God. We talked with one special guest who was probably in her later 70s. And she said, you know what my response is to this session? There's a iPhone app that's a game that I've become a little addicted to. And I need to delete it because it's distracting me from following Jesus. And I loved that somebody who wasn't the target audience for Urbana, which is college students, responded and said, I know what God is still speaking to me, and I'm going to say yes because I want to be available for his mission. And then I was at a prayer session, and a young woman came up to me. She's from India, studying here in the United States. She said, I feel like God might be calling me to mission, but I'm really wrestling with what are my obligations to support and care for my family. They've sacrificed everything for me to be there. And I felt privileged as a Asian American to be able to talk with her and pray with her and to wrestle with both the call, right, to honor and obey our parents, which is in scripture, and anybody who loves their mother and father more than me isn't worthy of the kingdom, and to hold those two in tension live before her. And she just wanted to follow Jesus and honor the whole of his scriptures. And I think that gives you a picture of kind of the life-sized questions that people are asking, as well as the small steps of obedience that people are taking across generations at Urbana.
Oh, God, that's a great story. Just, you know, it's so fun to hear the impact on an individual level of some of the ministry that you are doing at InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, as well as what's happening at Urbana. We'll take a short pause here, but when we come back, I know there's a lot more you and I can talk about, and that is some of the challenges facing the next generation and how that impacts their view of global mission. So we'll talk about that next with Gregory Yao on Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. It's about 10 minutes before the top of the hour. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and having a lively conversation with Gregory Yao of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship and some recent reflections on the Urbana Conference. And Greg, it seems to me that over the last 10, 15 years, there's been multiple tsunamis from a sociological standpoint that have swept over us, you know, sexuality, technology, individualization, all of these things. And we're trying to sort of rebuild a foundation underneath us. And that's part of what you even see among young people in terms of what they're interested in pursuing, whether it's social justice, sexism, racism, these kinds of things. What did you see in this most recent version of Urbana relative to those subjects?
Yeah, thanks for asking, Peter. One of the things I say about the current generation is they accept the doctrine of sin better than any generation before them. And by that, what I mean is they're willing to follow Jesus. They're willing to commit to mission. They're willing to commit and engage the local church. But they also want Christians to acknowledge where sin exists, both inside the church and outside the church. And so if we're honest, transparent, willing to confess, I think you'll find students saying, because I can trust you and you have integrity, I will follow. So at Urbana, at on the session that we focused on Revelation 18, as the text demands, we invited people to repent of the places where the church reflected too much the spirit of Babylon. And students responded in prayer and in commitment. And that was the session right before we invited them, will you accept God's call to global mission? And so what I find striking about this generation is they're so aware of the failures of the world, right, in human trafficking, in sexism, in sexual assault, that they're longing for the church to be a distinctive voice. And at Urbana this year, we focused on the book of Revelation, in part because the focus is so clearly on Jesus crucified and risen that, it strikes me the church should be the place, the first place in the world where people can say, I failed, will you forgive me? And what students have said is when we find people who follow Jesus deeply enough to acknowledge their sins and confess them and receive forgiveness from him and aren't worried about their image or aren't worried about how they're perceived on a selfie or in social media, they find that compelling.
And for the young people, too, just trying to find an anchor, I assume that there can be a connection between the historical invitations of our faith towards missions, towards helping people, and social justice. And, Greg, it seems like those two things are too often divorced in the conversation, where we sort of have thrown out the past in light of the future. But you're really seeking ways to bring those conversations together.
Absolutely. One way that many missiologists talk about it is it's a little bit like the right wing and left wing of an airplane. Which one do you need? You need both. And John Stott, a great church leader in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, used to say, we have both the Great Commission, which is to go proclaim the gospel and make disciples, and you have the Great Commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. And he said, let's not divorce two great invitations from God, proclaim my glory among the nations and invite people into salvation and love them as I love them and provide for them as I would have provided for them. And when you hold the Great Commission and the Great Commandment together, then I think you reflect the fullness of what God is doing, and that we proclaim the glory of God, certainly in our words. And Urbana was very clear this year from the first talk given by our director, Ruth Hubbard, where she said, look, the church has failed multiple times in its history in missions, but the reason we participate in mission is God has invited us to do so, and because conversion is essential. People have to turn and follow Jesus to have eternal life. Let's never forget that. And that was a clear thread through Urbana. And simultaneously, if you love them enough to want them to become brothers and sisters in the faith, shouldn't you care for them as if they were brothers and sisters in the faith? Mm-hmm. And I think students get that. I think they would say both are essential and both are part of what we need to do.
Well, Greg, I'm going to be honest. I'm going to steal that one and probably use it, and I'll try to give you credit where I can. But I love that combination of the Great Commandment and the Great Commission. That really does bring these two realms together.
Yeah, well, and John Stott was a British author and writer who I think wrote that first in the 1970s. But the church has affirmed this globally. There were these great congresses, the Lausanne Congress in 1974. And there's another one in Manila in, I believe, the 1990s, and then at Cape Town in 2010. And every time the global church gathers together, what they say is, let's not divorce what God has joined together. And while, of course, evangelism has to be primary, the fact that it's primary doesn't mean it's exclusive. And I think what the world longs to see, right, is the church which proclaims the truth and lives out the truth in all the ways that it can. And I think students responded to that. We had at Urbana this year over 222 students say that they made first-time commitments to follow Jesus. I think it says something that there were over 200 students who were not yet Christians at the conference, but when they heard a compelling vision of who Jesus is as revealed in the scriptures, and then we're invited to participate in his mission, which involved right heart and hand and mind. They said yes. And the woman who gave the invitation is on the staff of a church in California. Her name is Beth Paz. She had the ushers hand out white flags to anybody who wanted to stand and say, I'm going to follow Jesus for the first time. And it was just great to have them wave these white flags of surrender, saying, I am giving up. I'm surrendering all of who I am and all of my desires to follow Jesus instead. And to watch 200-plus students wave those flags was really, anybody, I think, who had a live faith had tears in their eyes.
That is a great story. Greg, we have just about a minute left, too. And as you look ahead to 2021 and some of the next Urbana opportunities, what do you see moving forward for the young people there?
First, I hope they're reviewing and reflecting on the messages, all of which are available on urbana.org. But mostly, our goal for students right now is follow up. If you feel God called you to global mission in a few years, that's wonderful. Read books, get Operation World, and pray for the nations, which is a great resource. But then begin to share your faith locally. If you can't name the name of Jesus to your classmate, to the person in your neighborhood, you're never going to do it overseas. Begin now. Invite people into your life. Share who Jesus is and develop consistency in witness before you go so that you're faithful when you actually get there.
Well, Greg, we certainly appreciate you joining us, walking us through all of this, and really grateful for the work that you do. So have a great rest of the week and, again, a great 2019 ahead.
Thank you so much, Peter. You as well.
We'll take a break and preview what's coming up next in Hour 2 for Faith Radio Mornings. So encouraging to talk to somebody like Greg just about, he's in the front lines at the youth and about the youth and what they're looking for, and that this kingdom just continues generation after generation. Well, up next on Faith Radio Mornings, after top of the hour news, we'll be joined by Dr. David Stevens of the Christian Medical and Dental Association. We are going to talk quite a bit about the rising costs of drugs in our country, as well as best overall diets for 2019.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.